things I cannot change. Courage changes things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Tonight our 40-minute speaker is Diana B. from Laverne.
Hi, I'm Diana, and I'm an alcoholic. 40-minute speaker. All righty, let's see now. 20 after? Welcome, welcome, welcome. I was thinking how crazy it is to get up here and tell you guys all of my weird history and be that honest, and you put it on the web. And, you know, but then I was thinking, no, it's crazy to take 10 shots of 100-proof Smirnoff. And I did that without thinking about it twice. So this is not crazy. In fact, this is me coming here to tell you why I'm not crazy today. And it's an honor to do it. I want to welcome the newcomers especially. My heart is just full thinking about you and thinking about me and what it was like when I stuck my hand up in that room full of people at a speaker meeting and told the truth finally about myself, which was that I was and am an alcoholic. But I fought that designation with all of the tooth and nail. I fought it like we all do. That's the last thing I wanted to be. Last thing I wanted to be was a speaker at an AA meeting. Are you kidding me? I remember I got a DUI in my early 20s, and I ended up at a speaker meeting in Santa Monica. And it just seemed like there was like 800 people there, you know. And the guy told some wild story, and I just didn't identify. I didn't want to identify. And I remember a woman came up afterwards, and she said, oh, you're new, you know. And I wondered how she could tell. And then she said, here's my phone number if you can't make it through the night. And I went straight to contempt. Okay, that's my default. I go straight to contempt and arrogance. Can't make it through the night. How pathetic is she? You know, I'm going to go home and not drink tonight, of course. I didn't know the fact that I had to not drink meant that I was an alcoholic. Because, see, I was good at not drinking. Well, I'm not going to drink tonight because I have to go somewhere tomorrow. I'm not going to drink until we get to Cabo because I want to lose weight for my swimsuit. I'm not going to drink in the morning because that would make me a drunk. And so I remember one time when I was wrestling with my gorilla, and this man asked me, well, you used to have a drug addiction? Because I had told him that I had overcome a drug addiction to make him feel better about his daughter. And he said, did you go to a program? And I said, no, I just stopped, you know. And he said, yeah, because do you drink? And I said, well, you know, what's that have to do with anything? And he said, well, because if you go to a program, usually they have you quit all substances, including alcohol. And I'm starting to not like this guy at all, right? And I said, well, you know, I don't drink more than I drink. And he said, well, how much time do you have to spend thinking about not drinking? And, oh, I did not like that man at all. What are you talking about? So my thinking's all screwed up. But today, happily, I think through AA. I let you think for me. We're all crazy, but we're not all crazy on the same day. So I have a whole lot of people that I can reason things out with. And I have people who call me and reason things out in their life. And I can tell them, you know, yeah, that sounds crazy. Or no, that actually doesn't sound crazy. Because one of the things that's happening to me is the years are going by, happy birthday, is that I'm starting to be able to do things I couldn't do, and when I do them, I get this triggered feeling like, oh, isn't this my old behavior, and I just bought a new car, and I just extended my finances, and I've just been feeling like a tweaker all week, no offense to the tweakers, but, you know, I'm like at the bank with a credit card going, give me a couple $1,000 right now, you know, So I'm talking to my sponsor, and I'm reasoning it out, and I'm actually looking at the money, and I'm thinking about what it's going to cost, and I'm looking at how much I make, and and it's new behavior, but it feels a lot like old behavior. So let me tell you who I am. I'm a kid from Pomona. Parents came from Ohio, where they met at Ohio State and got pregnant as undergraduates. Go Buckeyes. So I have a feeling alcohol had something to do with it. And but they made it out here to California by the time I was born. I was the youngest of three, two older brothers, 9 years older than me. And it was a loving, stable, alcoholic home. Mom was the Al-Anon, not recovering in Al-Anon. Dad was the alcoholic, not recovering in Alcoholics Anonymous. So Mom spent most of her energy, it's exhausting to be an unrecovered Al-Anon as well as to be an alcoholic woman, by the way. She spent most of her energy trying to make everything look like it was not crazy in our household. We're just regular, lovely, middle-class people with a regular, lovely, middle-class home, and there's absolutely no diseases in our family. And, you know, that just took it out of her. She died younger than she should have because she didn't know that my dad's drinking was none of her business. And I didn't know that either. And it became my business. And I remember one of the first times, I was thinking back, you know, those traumatic moments. It says in the 12 and 12 that there's these moments when we're traumatized and we get twisted emotionally. We twist, you know. And then, of course, that first drink for me, I was like, oh, I don't feel so twisty, you know. And so I was thinking back to a time when I was twisted. It was 1969. I was 7 years old, and my family had taken a trip to the Bahia in San Diego. And I remember very vividly what year it was because we heard them land on the moon on the way down there on the radio, and I see people of a certain age are nodding. And it was exciting. We also saw 2001 at the Cinerama Dome, which I don't recommend a seven-year-old see. So that was a scary and odd experience. But much worse than that was, I'm with my older brothers. We're out by the pool. It's real exciting. There was a Lotus I pulled up. Remember, a car, you know, the car. And my brother's like, oh, you got to come see this car. You know, Diana. But then there was an ambulance. And then it's your father. And then it was your father's hurt. And something's happened. And they're loading my daddy into the ambulance. And before I can find out why and what's happening, my mother grabbed me by the hand and she yanked me across the parking lot and she said, that's it. I'm divorcing him. I've had it. And I'm like, no, please, don't divorce daddy. Don't divorce daddy. Okay, so it's just run-of-the-mill alcoholic family stuff. I mean, now I know it's not a big deal. This stuff happens every day. Turned out he'd done a high dive, I guess. I guess he was drunk because Mom was sure pissed. And he was tall, and he cracked his skull open on the bottom of the pool. And so he went off to the hospital with bleeding from the head. But we didn't go visit him in the hospital, and nobody ever talked to me about what it felt like to be that little girl whose mother's screaming in the parking lot, whose father's being taken away in an ambulance, right? And the next day, it's like nothing ever happened. I spent, you know, the majority of the rest of my life afraid my mother would leave my father. Then I started becoming afraid that she wouldn't. You know, it's like, maybe you should leave him. I don't know. This is getting confusing. But what I started to accrue was an awful lot of shame. And that shame was just my second nature. I didn't know there was any other way to feel. But the last thing I was going to do was let you know that, okay? So I became quite the chameleon. And some of you may identify with that. I would not have ever told you anything was wrong. And as I said, quite often, if you were the paramedic helping me out of my own, you know, vomit and problem that I'd caused, I was probably looking at you and thinking, God, you know, could you update your haircut, right? Because I just go straight to arrogance and contempt when you're trying to help me. That's my default because it's like a protective armor. And then I don't have to look at myself, and I didn't want to look at myself. I wanted to create the person that you wanted me to be, okay? Took time. Effort, it was exhausting. So double winners, we're tired. And my other big trauma in childhood was they skipped me, actually, from second to third grade. And I was already really emotionally crippled by fear, and I was more comfortable at home by far with my family. It was a big, loud, rowdy, noisy, lots of men, lots of fun. My brothers knock each other through windows and stuff, you know, but then the other half of the time they're driving around in a van shooting these, you know, BB guns at people while they're babysitting me. It was exciting, you know. And we went to Dodger games and Lakers games and Rams games, and my brothers were always sneaking me up where you're not supposed to be. And here's my little sister. Let's get her, you know, Tommy John's going to autograph your hat. And so I liked my family, and I was comfortable with them. But when I had to go to school, I was just scared to death. And I didn't want to admit that to anybody, and I assumed no one else ever felt that way, which is why I'm so grateful to be in a room full of people that know what fear feels like, you know? And just really grateful. I didn't have anything to be afraid of, by the way, by far. In fact, they came and told me and told my mother, oh, your daughter's special and gifted, and we want her to go to a higher grade, you know? But all I knew was when I got to the third grade classroom and realized I was going to have to be with older kids, my guts just ran cold, and I wanted to scream no, and no, 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 no. But I didn't, because I did not know how to speak up for myself, and I didn't know I was allowed to be who I am, so I thought I had to say, that's great, let's go. And I walked in that door, and I sucked it up, and as far as I was concerned, I became an official phony, because I'm not a third grader. They are. They're older than me. They've made ashtrays. I've not made the ashtray because I came in 2 weeks into the semester. So, of course, I did the next best thing, and you know what it is. I stole one because I'm a liar, a cheat, and a thief. I did not know I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief until I got into 12-step programs. That was just how I rolled. I'm a rip. You know, I need something I don't have, and I'm going to take it from you. And you're not even going to know it, and you're going to thank me, and you're going to admire me for having it. That's me. It's not pretty. But I took that ashtray home. I crossed out Tony. He carved his name in the bottom, poor Tony. And I wrote Diana and showed it to my mommy. Look what I made in school today. Because, you know, third graders make ashtrays, and I'm a third grader now, so God knows I better have a freaking ashtray. And so she flips it. She says, "Oh, pretty, honey." She flips it over, and she says, "Why does it say Tony on the bottom?" And, of course, immediately, without a thought, I lied. And I said, "He stole mine. He stole mine, and he carved his name in mine before they were drawn." Son of a bitch, you know? And so Mom's like, "That's terrible, honey." And she set it there on the bookshelf, and there the lie sat. There the lie sat for the rest of my childhood and into my adulthood. The lie. Diana can't make an ashtray. Diana's not really a good student. Diana doesn't really know what's going on. And she's a cheat, and she's a thief, and she's a liar. And, you know, I didn't know any of that consciously. I can tell you that now, but I didn't know till I knew. But I did know something was wrong with me. And I was very happy, therefore, when I had that first drink. For me, it wasn't until I was 12. We had, you know, I'm late compared to some of you guys. But I was in ninth grade by then. And it was just lovely. It was really wonderful. You know, slow gin fizz with my best friend. And we laughed and we had a good time. And I'm sure I threw up and I didn't care. I mean, it's the same story. The first birthday guy told our story, right? First we drank and it was fun. Then there were some problems, but it was still fun. And then there were more problems and it got less fun. You know, and now I'm in an AA meeting. Wow. So I started to drink. I was not interested in becoming the kid that drank in the morning and had it in her thermos and got in a lot of trouble. So again, I told you, I'm a chameleon. I maintained an outward appearance of the good child. By now, my brother has had a nervous breakdown. He's been schizophrenic. He's sent up to Vacaville, where he's hanging out with Manson, sending me his autograph and picture. My parents, I know my parents have a problem child, and somehow I knew, as the child of an alcoholic often decides, as long as I never have anything wrong with me ever, my mommy's going to be okay. So she couldn't know what I went through. That was the math in my head. So yeah, I started drinking, but no, I was not going to let my mom know. And my friends started wearing pot leaves and stuff, and I'm like, are you stupid? They're going to know. Like, you don't tell people that you're doing things that are illegal. You know, we're in high school. There was a smoking section at my high school, legal, you know, smoking section. It was the 70s by then. I smoked, but I wouldn't go in it. I'm like, why would you want to get branded as a kid who smokes? Like, just be a big phony. Like, I thought that, you know, made me superior because I just wasn't authentic. So I thought that would get me out of trouble. And it did permit me to drink for a long time and take drugs for a long time. I went on to college. I went on to graduate school. And I was really horrified in graduate school because, remember, I'm a second grader. So now a second grader is with the big dogs. I'm in an elite program. It's top 10. It was 11th, actually, when I was there. But now it's top 10, and I always said it was top 10. I heard a speaker once say I lied when the truth was good enough. I could identify with that. But so I'm at this excellent program, and here's what I know. I know this, right? I know everybody else went to an Ivy League school for their undergrad. I know they all rocked a 4.0. I know none of them's ever done drugs, and I know they all know what they're doing here, and I know they all know how to be good students. And then there's Diana, right? So you better believe I'm thirsty. I'm real thirsty. And I go to class, and there's people afraid of me. People are afraid of me. And meanwhile, I'm just utterly fear-based and lost and getting hammered in Westwood every night, you know, because you can't. It's grad school, and we're talking about, you know, Nietzsche. And we're too smart to have a problem, like, right? And I remember one time I had such a hangover in a class. I thought I was going to die. You know, I was trying to say, how are you? Such a horrible hangover. And he said, well, you look good. And I thought, oh, okay, then everything's okay, right? That's the training of my childhood. As long as you don't know I have a problem, I don't have a problem. The fears are escalating. I'm sure I'm a phony. I'm sure that on some level, I'm going to get found out. I'm sure it was a mistake. I was admitted into this graduate program. But meanwhile, like I said, I'm not asking for help. I watch these shows where, like, the kid tells her mom she has a drug problem or something. And I'm like, God, how do you do that? I could have never told anybody. I didn't even ask for help learning how to write a paper. I had to learn how to write a paper by becoming a professor. You know, there's no way I was going to ask somebody, can you show me how to do this? Because I didn't really pay much attention in college. You know, I was mostly drinking and doing drugs. Around that time, my great aunt died. She was like 98, and from Ohio. And I was throwing out her stuff. She didn't have any kids. And I found this little black thing. I was about to throw it away, and I was rubbing it, and I realized it was a gold watch, and it was the gold retirement watch her husband had been given in 1945. He was a jeweler, and it said to Renee J. Allen from his friends at Bailey Banks in Biddle, 1945. And I thought, holy shit, this is a gold retirement watch. Mine, right? So I put a band on it, and I put it on, and I loved that watch. I used to be terrified of losing it. Along the line, I got a gold band for it. So I had a solid gold watch. And so I'm walking around with a solid gold watch, and I'm thinking, you know what? I may not have any idea what I'm doing, and I may be utterly stupid, and I may be a total phony, and I'm pretty sure I'm also fat and ugly, but I've got a really pigeon watch. And it was just hugely important to me, because remember that arrogance, that ego base, was what I hung on to. And so, you know, so once in a while people notice it, and I'm like, oh, right, it's a family piece. Right, like I'm from the Rockefellers or something. And it wasn't that I found it in this empty check register that was about to get thrown away. So proud of it, you know, so happy. So I'd have dreams that I would lose it. Around that time, my mother gets a horrible cancer. So now I'm supposed to be getting a PhD, don't know how. I'm trying to stop my father's drinking. That is going badly. We had many wars over that. Doesn't he know his drinking is hurting us? Then now I've got to cure this cancer, and it's a kind I never even heard of. And so I basically had a spiritual awakening and decided to shoot my dad. Because I'm homicidal, not suicidal. It's two sides of that same old coin, but I don't want to kill myself. I want to kill you. And so I thought I would bring peace to my mother while she struggled with a terminal illness by murdering her husband. And I had a gun, because by then my brother had committed suicide, and I had inherited a gun from him that I didn't want, but I didn't know how to say no when my dad said, you know, here's his gun. So I thought, I'm going to kill him, I'm going to kill my mom's doctor, because she, you know, he's obviously responsible for all of this too. I'm never responsible for anything. And at that moment, the day I'm planning those murders, I also walk into the doors of an Al-Anon meeting. And I didn't know what it was, or I would not have walked in. If you had said, oh, Al-Anon's a program for people who have been affected by other people's alcoholism so that they can recover and have a spiritual path, I would have been like, loser, first of all, I don't have a problem. My problem is that dad, that doctor, those professors, that guy who slept with me and told everybody, and, you know, I got problems, you know, but they're all men. Come to think of it. And so I got 99 problems and they are all male. And so I walked in to see who teaches you how to get an alcoholic sober, because I was at that point, that was my first droplet of humility. I was ready to say, look, I have tried to get my dad sober for 33 years. He's still just drinking. I'm going to kill him unless you stop it. But instead of that, I heard something else, because that was clearly my bottom. I hit an Al-Anon bottom before my AA bottom. That's all there is to that. If you're about to kill your alcoholic, you know, you're having an Al-Anon slip, I'm telling you. So what I heard at that first meeting, this is what I heard, was I've been affected by my father's alcoholism. It's given me a lot of baggage. It's messed me up. But I can be okay, and I can have a good time in spite of the fact that I come from this sick, twisted-up family if I keep coming back. Good. That's what I heard, and I have. So that was 18 and a half years ago. And they said to get a higher power, and I was like, I knew they were Christian. You know, no, they really didn't care what, as long as it wasn't me. And so once I slowly popped my head out and was ready to go, yeah, you know, I am kind of failing at everything I'm trying to do, like fix mom, fix dad. I couldn't fix my brother who wouldn't take his lithium. You know, I was kind of ready to admit, maybe I'm not the highest power in the universe. So I picked the moon. And cheers to it. I don't know if you noticed it tonight, but I sure did. And I didn't hang it. That's all I need to know. Diana, did you hang the moon? No. Okay, well, then you're not in charge of the universe, so why don't you relax and do the dishes, right? And so it has simplified things for me. Stay out of their business. I heard a friend tonight said she was going to come down here from the west side, and I wanted to email her back and go, for crying out loud, do you know how far it is from the west side to San Clemente and on a Friday night? And then I thought, Diana, it's none of your business. You're not the concierge of the human race. So back it off. And I didn't say anything, and it's lovely to see my dear friend, and I'm so glad she's joined us in these rooms, because I didn't meet her in these rooms. So anyway, I kept coming back. My life got better. Relationships were straightening out all over the place. And I actually finished that PhD, and I got a job in Texas as a college professor, and I moved away, and I took that job. And every moment of that was holding the hands of my Al-Anon friends and my sponsor, because it turned out, and this is when I found it out, was scared. I didn't know I was. I'd always been like the swaggering badass. I'm not afraid of anything, you know. Well, it turned out I was. I'm afraid of just about everything you can possibly think of. Good things, bad things, yesterday, tomorrow, this morning, you, me, you name it. And so I had to grow up. I chose to grow up. My mom chose to let me grow up, and I moved away to Texas. And then I spent 4 years trying very hard not to drink too much in that little town. So, you know, I told you, I have control. It's chapter 3, right? Well, I'm not going to go out tonight with those people, or, you know, I'm only going to have 2 Corona Lights tonight. You know, my journals, I'm journaling by now because of Al-Anon, and they're just filled with me going, okay, last night, here's what I had. Wasn't too bad. And I don't know I'm an alcoholic, but I'm starting to get enough clarity in my life to realize that blacking out, which I'm a blackout drunk, and coming to the next day isn't normal, and it's not great, and it's not great for your spiritual path, and it's not great for your self-esteem. And I was starting to like the self-esteem that I was building. I was starting to do good in the world. I had learned to be of service. I am such an arrogant, entitled taker that when I delivered Meals on Wheels in graduate school with a friend because she wanted me to, I asked her at one point, why do you do this? You know, like, why would you go take old people food if you don't have to, you know? But I drank with her and I wanted her to like me, so I was doing it, you know, because of her. But she said, well, I'm buying real estate in heaven. She was Catholic. And it didn't mean a thing to me. I was raised Protestant, and I had long ago abandoned that. And so I was like, eh, whatever. So, you know, I didn't realize, oh, giving back is the right thing to do until I got into a 12-step program. So, for example, I signed up to deliver Meals on Wheels in 2000 when I signed my father up to get them. And I've been doing it ever since because it's the right thing to do. So I'm there in Texas. I'm in a publish or perish profession, and that means that you have to write scholarship and publish it, and I can't. And this is why. This is what I knew. You're too stupid, and you're a total phony, and they hired you, but they were wrong. They were wrong. And now you have to do every single thing you can do to try to do what they want you to do, but you know you don't know how to do it. And, you know, that's my world, and I'm uptight. So my spouse calls and says he's gotten an offer at a university in California. And hallelujah, I'm free. I quit my job. I quit my great job that was hard to get, and you had to work hard to get, and you had to do a lot of schooling to get, and I dropped it like a hot rock because it let me off the hook. Now I don't have to be that person who can't do what I'm supposed to do. And we moved back to California. I ended up being the primary caregiver of my dad, which was interesting considering that I wanted to kill him. But I had learned that it's okay to love an alcoholic, which becomes important in my own story. So, because I'm not one, right? He's one. I'm not one. Oh, no. I'm just a social drinker. No, I'm a heavy social drinker. Well, I'm going to stick to 3 a night. Well, 3 is not. Well, 4. Okay. I'm going to stick to 4. You know what it is? It's when I'm just going to drink champagne. Oh, you know what? It's when I mix. Don't mix. Oh, you know, it's because I forgot to eat dinner. Oh, you know what? If I just drink a glass of water in between. No. If I slow down. You know what? If I don't hang around with her anymore. She gets me drunk, so she's out, right? And so I am just frantically managing, spinning these plates to figure out how I can keep drinking, because I'm standing here tonight to tell you, I don't live life without alcohol. I don't live life without alcohol. That's all there is to it. I'll live life without interfering in other people's business. That other program, no problem. but without alcohol? Oh, I don't think so. So I get hired by a university in Southern California for a job that's a much lower pressure, much lower demand. I start doing that, and in the meanwhile, I start being of service there because I've learned to say yes to requests, and so I start doing service commitments at my job. One of the service commitments I took on was to be a mentor, a faculty mentor to the students, and so in 2005, I was invited to the faculty mentor banquet, and of course, I told the student who invited me, no, like, that sounds dull. Like, why would I go to that? Some work banquet? And she said, oh, please go, because if you do, we can get more seats for students. And I was like, well, oh, all right. And she said, and come to my dorm room first, and we'll pre-party. And so I said, fine, but I'm not going to drink your college rot gut, so I'm going to bring some good alcohol, because don't you know I'm a sophisticate. And so I did. I brought enough for each, tequila for to each have two drinks. And we had our lovely, you know, tequila drinks, and she told me how much she admired me, and she told me that she wanted to be me when she grew up. And, you know, I had learned in Al-Anon that I'm not a piece of crap and that good things are true. And I let that in and I let that sink in. And I knew I had mentored that young woman and I knew that this was good. And then I had my first craving in my life, because when those two drinks were gone, I heard my head say, more, more, more. I heard it. And it was like, where's this banquet? How far away is it? Is there going to be liquor there? What else is there? Get something else to drink. Get it now. Okay, so remember, I'm the chameleon who keeps everything clean, you know, at work, in school. I'm not the tragic, you know, teacher with liquor on her breath. You know, I've had those, and I had contempt for them. Oh, my God, she's been drinking, you know. Oh, so I turned to the student, and I said, what else you got? What else you got? What else you got? She said, well, I have 100 proof Smirnoff. So 10 shots of that later, or whatever. Who knows how many? I don't care. We got to the yacht where the banquet was. By then, I am blacking in and out. They're begging me to eat. I'm like, no, 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 bathroom, bathroom. So that same student who 2 hours before had told me that she wanted to be me when she grew up ended up holding my hair while I vomited in the toilet. And then I passed out on a chaise lounge that was there in the ladies' room. As I came to during the evening, she came downstairs and she said, you are going to get the Faculty Mentor of the Year award tonight. I didn't. They chose not to give it to me. And when we got back to campus, by then, of course, I'm doing the, you know, what? I don't know what you're talking about, you know. I have my dignity routine. And an administrator met us and said, are you, yes, I am, you know, Dr. So-and-so. Well, we've arranged somewhere for you to sleep this evening. Oh, thank you very much. You know, like I'm visiting royalty, you know, and not this tragic, drunken faculty member. So they put me to bed in the graduate student's room. She was out of town. And I came to around 5 a.m. It was pouring rain, and I had my moment of clarity. I looked around where I was, and it all came back to me, and my head said, that happened because you're an alcoholic. And I knew what that meant. I knew what that meant. I knew for the rest of my life, when I picked up a drink, I could no longer guarantee my own safety. I could no longer guarantee the outcome. I was done with the lie. I was done with the lie that I had any power over alcohol. But I also knew I would never stop drinking. So if you have ever been in that position, I understand, and I'm right there with you, brothers and sisters. It's a rotten place to be. I cannot go on the way I've been going, and I absolutely cannot change. I didn't even want to. I did not want to give up alcohol. So I went home after a couple of days. I scraped together about a thimbleful of self-esteem because of a decade of Al-Anon, because of the fact that it's okay to love an alcoholic, because of the fact that I knew I wasn't a piece of garbage, that I was an intensely sick human being with a disease, the same disease that killed my father. He begged me for a drink on his deathbed. Booze, 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 booze. That's how my beautiful, brilliant father went out at 82. And I knew that there I am. I'm his kid, you know. I've got a whole lot of qualities just like my dad. And, you know, I've got his shins and I've got his alcoholism. So anyway, I did call my Al-Anon sponsor then. I told her what had happened. And I drowned in Cabo a few weeks before and some other stuff I've left out. And she said, it was an undertow. She said, go to AA tomorrow. And I said, there's no point in me going to AA because I will never stop drinking. And she said, you do not have to stop drinking to go to AA. We do not shoot our wounded. So, you know, my head said a lot of things, but my mouth said okay, because I had learned to take direction in that other 12-step program. And I went into the house, miserable and wretched. I had a glass of wine. I went to bed, and I woke up changed. I woke up changed. As soon as I opened my eyes, I was in the, it was like, it's like Dorothy waking up in Oz. I'm sober. It was like this beautiful crystalline world with no alcohol in it, and I was in it, and I wanted to be in it. And I knew that I'd been delivered of my alcoholism. So that was May 1st of 2005. I ran and called my AA sponsor, my Al-Anon sponsor. I said, will you sponsor me in AA too? Because now I've woken up to change. And she said, well, and she paused. And I'm sensitive. I don't know about you, but I hear pauses. You know, I don't like pauses. I want like gushing, you know, enthusiasm. She said, you'd have to go to an AA meeting every day this week. Of course, my head said, why? I woke up changed. I don't have to go to those meetings with those people, with those cigarettes, with those cups of coffee, with the, you know, no. But my head said, okay. And you know, by about day two, I'd heard, we get this gift, however we get it, and then we give it up, and we go out, and we lose our liver, and we lose our life, and we lose our family, and we lose our car, and we lose our bank account, and we lose all of it and more. And you know what? It scared the holy hell out of me. And 8.5 years later, I am scared to death that alcoholism will get me if I don't stay safe in the middle of this lifeboat, which is why I would drive down here on a Friday night to San Clemente and turn down the $20 for gas that was offered to me, even though there's nothing in my bank account right now, because I owe AA. AA doesn't owe me a thing. AA doesn't owe me a thing. I'm here to save my life, and if I can say a single thing to anybody in this room that helps her, hallelujah. Hallelujah. My life has meaning today. I kind of feel sorry for people that don't have these awful diseases, you know, because my life is just filled with meaning all day long. I have all these steps. I know how to live. I've got all these friends. You know, my life keeps getting better and better. I see pain in people's eyes, and I can see it, and I can go, oh, you're in pain, you know, and I don't think I caused it most of the time, but I can tell them there's hope, you know, and it's freaking great. So what happened? Well, I get sober. And I go to a meeting, and I got like 90 days, I don't know. And the speaker gets up, and she says, I was a prostitute in Alaska, and I woke up one day in an alley. I came to, and I don't know what had happened to me, and my watch was gone. And my head said, you have a solid gold watch. You have a European sports car in the parking lot. You are not these people. We're leaving. And I stood up to leave. And by the door was a man I had known from Al-Anon, because his wife was in Al-Anon until she had died. And that was her husband, Ralph. And I'd always known he was in AA. And the other part of my head said, tell Ralph what you're thinking. Tell him. So I went up and I said, Ralph, I never prostituted. I don't belong here. And he said, do you want to pass out at another banquet in your honor? No, nailed it, turned around, went back, sat down. And so by now I'm teaching, and every time I'm teaching this one thing, I'm telling my students, I'm going to write this up as an article, because, you know, that's what we do in my profession. And my head goes, no, you're not, you liar, never, never. And I knew I wouldn't. I knew I was lying. And then a couple of years go by, and I said the same thing to the class. I'm going to write this up as an article. And the other part of my head said, yep, here we go. And I went home, and I wrote it. And I published it, and I wrote another one, and I published that one. And then I had the second highest person in power at my university hear about one of them, want to read it, and I sent it to her, guts running cold with fear. How can they, when are they going to find out who I really am? But you know what it says in the big book? We crawl before no man. I got nothing to hide. You want to read something I wrote here? You don't? Fine. But you know what? I can write today. I was wrong about being stupid and not being able to write. I was a very sick alcoholic woman, and that's a part of my story. That is my story, basically. So meanwhile, I go to get my watch out of the closet a couple years ago to wear to an AA meeting, because I had a tan, and wouldn't that look pretty? And I realized that it was in a boot that I had donated to the Goodwill. Oops. That was a bad moment. I felt like a horse had kicked me in the gut. And I got down in the fetal position, and you know what I did then? My husband said, well, what do you want to do now? And I said, I want to go to our meeting we're going to. He's like, "You want to go to the meeting now?" I was like, "Oh, especially now. Yes, please. Yes, please." So I went to the meeting and I cried and I talked it out, and the women were nice and the men were saying, "Ha ha," you know. And I went home and ate a box of cookies and went to bed. And then I started to get all the gifts that come when something's taken away. I didn't know that I didn't think I deserved that watch. I didn't know that I thought that if I had that watch, you'd like me, and if I didn't have that watch, you wouldn't. I didn't know that I was actually worthy without a nice watch. I didn't know it till my higher power took it away, and I got real grateful, real grateful. That's my arc. I go from, "How dare you take this from me," to, "Thank you," to, "Oh, thank you," to, "Wow, how much cooler is life now that I've gone in this completely different direction?" I even did that with a speeding ticket the other day. Ask me about that one sometime. But so anyway, my friend said, "Why don't you tell your insurance?" And I told them, they gave me $5,000. And so you know what? With my sponsor, I bought a new gold watch. My watch. It's mine. I own it. It's not some phony watch and some phony fam, some phony blah, blah, blah. It's just mine. It's mine. I chose to, and I bought it. And then you know what happened? My husband's pulling something out of the hardware cabinet, and out flies that freaking old watch. I forgot where I hid it. Oh, so I'm like, "Oh dear, you know, I better make a donation to the Goodwill," because I've gone and reamed the manager's ass because I was so sure. I'm like, "Oh, I donated a boot and all the jewelry." And he's like, "Oh no, ma'am." I thought, "I can tell you're lying, you SOB." And I'm going to all these pawn shops and I'm making flyers and posters. But you know what? Where I put one of those posters on the altar that I have, because I have a spiritual path today. Surrender, Dorothy. And so I called my sponsor. I said, "I found the watch. I guess I better make a nice donation to the Goodwill." And she paused. And I thought, "Oh God, here it comes." And she said, "No, you have to give the $5,000 back to the insurance company." And I'm like, "But I spent it. I don't have $5,000. And she said, "Then you save it up and you pay it back." And I knew right in that moment that Diana, the little liar, cheat, and thief, would never do that. So I called them that day, and I said, "Hi, I found the watch." And they're like, "Oh my God, no one's ever called us before to tell us this." And I said, "Well, I have to be honest today. I have to be honest today." And so they called me back later, and they said, "Yeah, you can keep the new one and keep this jewelry." It all worked out. And they said, "We just really appreciate you being honest. We really appreciate you being honest." It was a miraculous turn of events in my life, a miraculous turn of events in my life. But I have to tell you the truth. I have to do the hard thing and tell the truth. Recently I was at a reception at school, and a student was talking to me, and everybody was drinking all around me. I wasn't drinking. I don't drink. I'm an AA. And she said, "You know, you're so carefree. I want what you have. It's real, and you're not pretending." And I just sat there and let my heart swell up and my eyes fill with tears and know that it's a program of attraction. And that I'm a living, breathing testimony to the 12-step programs and to the value of surrender, of acceptance, of humility, of cleaning house, of serving others, of walking in love as my life's meaning. And at that moment, this person who's the second highest up in my university comes over and says, "Oh, I hear you have another article on this subject. I'd love to read this." Well, she already read it. It's the one I gave her already. And you know what happened? I ducked. And I lied. tweak it. I'll be right back. Out the door. I go home feeling like a pile of crap after a beautiful day where I did a bit of nothing but service, and my heart had been full all day until I lied to somebody, because all of a sudden, one more time, I wasn't enough. One more time, I was not enough. And I went to bed and I had a drunk dream. And in my drunk dream, I drank 2 tequilas. And I come back to you guys, and you weren't happy about it. It wasn't, "Oh, come on back, newcomer, oh, buddy." It was, "What? Why you?" I don't know. I said, "I have no idea. I don't know. I don't know." And the next day, I called my sponsor, and she explained, because it had triggered my shame. It had triggered my alcoholism, that I can't look the world in the eye. And I'm so ready to be done with that, I can't even tell you. So I sent this person a different article. I said, "You know what, that one's not in print. But here's one I wrote. Maybe you'll enjoy this one. Because I crawl before no man. I get to stand up and look people in the eye, even if they're second in command at multi-billion-dollar institutions." So I went to a retreat this weekend, and I before I pull onto the grounds of a retreat, I do what I've been directed to do, which is set an intention for the weekend. And my intention for this retreat with alcoholic women was that I want to know that I'm enough. I don't want to duck anymore. I'm done. And they had us burn something on a piece of paper, and I wrote, tell me I'm enough. I don't want to duck. And about an hour later, this woman came up and said, I have a present for you. And it was this beautiful little box with a moon on it, lacquer, gorgeous bling, loved it. But then she said, open it. And I opened it, and inside was this little homely hand-painted rock, and it said, I am enough. It was just, and there it is. Today, I don't have to question that, and I've already passed it on to the next woman who's reeling from alcoholism. She just took a year, and she said, I finally realized this is real. I finally realized I really have a problem with alcoholism. And I've been trying everything for a year to fill that hole besides alcohol, and I'm miserable. And I said, you know what, honey? I'm just here to know that I'm enough, and you're enough. And I got to give her that rock. Next week, I'm going to the Bahia. I haven't been back since 1969, but this time I'm taking a young student that I'm mentoring. And we're going to go to a conference together, and we're writing a paper together. And when I talked to her about it recently over lunch, she said, I've been having trouble this summer. I had kind of a nervous breakdown because I'm just really terrified that I'm not enough. And you know what I got to tell her? My story. It's the most valuable thing I have. It's the only thing I care about. I'm glad that I can also mentor her intellectually and professionally and help lift her up like people have lifted me up. But the bottom line is I also get to look her in the eye and say, you don't have to be anything more than you are. You don't have to be anything more than you are. I am enough. I went and made an ashtray with my friends. So I have my own at home with my chips in it. Because I'm not a phony. I'm not Tony. I'm Diana. I'm an alcoholic. That's all I need to be. Thanks for letting me share.